Well, hello, Cassie McCullough with you for Life Matters. You've heard the rest. Now let's hear the best. What do you think of the changes we've been hearing about in Scott Morrison's first budget? How did he go? Now, we're interested in hearing your verdict on the $80,000 club rising to $87,000. What do you think of that $6 a week tax cut you got if you are in that club? Love to hear from you. Also, the biggest changes to super since it was introduced. Will it change your planning? Should it change your planning? How will women fare? Will you be racing down to the bank to top up your super? All these questions and more. 1300 225 76 1300 225 76, or call RN. Now, South Australia and Northern Territory, call now and we'll still be able to catch you. Western Australia, of course, it's the listener line for you. 02 833 1430. 02 833 1430. Keen to hear your thoughts. We'll bring them to air tomorrow. What were the measures that you would have liked to have seen funded that weren't there? We'd like to hear all your views on the budget. You can also, of course, send us a text, or you jump on our Facebook page and we can read out your comments there. Joining us for this discussion is Cheryl Bagwell, who is business editor for ABCRN's Breakfast, of course. Morning, Cheryl.
Good morning, Cassie.
And you're in Canberra, as is our other guest, Peter Martin, economics editor from The Age. Welcome, Peter.
G'day, Cassie.
Let's start with you, Peter. And your theme, I think, can be summed up this way. Because I got to have faith. I got to have faith. Yes. The only person I saw to reference George Michael in their budget analysis. What are you telling us there?
I'm saying that that's the message of the budget. There are the super measures, which are extremely good, and I'll talk about them. But I'm sure we will. But the rest of it are tax cuts for companies, which will eventually bring the corporate tax rate down to 25% from 30%. And we're told there's economic modelling to support that. Now, we know that. We know what the government's advertising campaign will be, the nature of it, because the scripts were leaked.
I think it has something to do with jobs and growth, doesn't it?
Yes, and that it is quite specific. It will increase the size of the economy. Now, we're told that if company tax is cut, the economy will be 1% bigger in 20 years' time. But it's not intuitively right. That's why you have to have faith.
okay.
That's why Morrison knows a bit about faith, the treasurer. Intuitively, if companies, and for big ones, the Australian big companies on the whole don't pay tax because of dividend imputation. They pay out, their shareholders get it back. It's the foreign companies that pay tax, and cutting their tax rate you'd need to have faith, and you'd need to be a very good salesperson.
Okay, so two things there. That it's a big picture that we've been presented with, and that we have to hold tight and look for those long-term reforms. Now, Cheryl, last night I think Annabel Crabb, in her analysis, delivered one of the funniest lines, not unusually. She said that a lot of this budget is targeted at people you don't know, won't meet, and haven't got any sympathy for, and that is the superannuates in the top 4%, multinationals and smokers.
Well, we do know one beneficiary of this tax cut, in a sense, for personal income tax, because the temporary deficit levy will cease next year, and the Prime Minister will be a beneficiary of that. I mean, anybody over $250,000 will gain $1,400 sort of tax break, but those under $80,000 will get, $310 with the bracket creep measure. So that's, that won't even buy you a sandwich.
Just the milkshake.
Really. And actually, if we're talking about bracket creep, that measure won't last that long. I think by 2019, those same people, about 500,000 people, I think it affects, according to Treasury modelling, will move back up into that second highest tax bracket again. So it's a constant endeavour. But I think it's something that the government had to do because they kept talking about it. I mean, bracket creep isn't a huge problem because we don't have an inflation problem. Actually, we've got a deflation problem. Consumer prices are falling at the moment, but the government had been talking for a long time about bracket creep, and they had to do something in that area. It's just it's a modest tax cut, but they can frame it as being very prudent, not the kind of tax cuts that the Rudd Howard government gave away. And you have to say, I mean, when the Greens and Labor have complained that or criticised the measure, because I think 60 to 70% of taxpayers earn less than $80,000 a year. They're not getting a tax cut or help with bracket creep in this budget. But you have to say that low to middle income earners kind of did quite well over the previous budgets.
Yes, from and the mining you could argue
when
also
those, when Labor and Liberals did, you know.
Yeah, you could also argue
give
that
out a tax cut.
This group is carrying the biggest tax burden, paying more tax than any other sector in the community. Let's hear from somebody who is in this bracket, who's given us a call, and you can do the same, 1300 225 576. What's the thing that stuck out for you, and have you got a question for Peter or Cheryl about how you may well be affected? G'day to Michael in Oatley. You're in the 80K club.
Yeah, hi. How you going?
Yeah, what do you think of it?
Look, I think for me as an individual, every little bit helps, but I think I'd rather see it used on something, I guess, that'll benefit more people and have a bigger impact as a whole. So spending on education or health or even things like renewable energy would probably be something I'd be more into, rather than have a sort of a $300 a year bump in my sort of take-home pay. I guess my view.
Yeah, right. Okay. Thanks for that. That's an interesting point, isn't it? That if it's such a small break for people, why not keep it and spend it on, I don't know, hospitals or education or roads or other sectors of as we know, the community that are crying out, Peter?
Can I just say that I am feeling better about this budget as time goes on, better than I did yesterday? Yes, I'm prepared to forgive Scott Morrison for the $80,000 plus tax cut, moving up that rate from $80,000 to $87,000.
Forgive him for what reason?
Oh, I think treasurers, they've got bees in their bonnet. Look, it's a small tax cut given to people. He's, as Cheryl said, he's gone on about this for so long. You would expect him to do something. It's not big in the scheme of things. What is big, what I like about what is done, is the attacks on the outrageous largesse, which has been directed to high-income superannuants. They've also given money to low-income superannuants. The Labor had a scheme that paid money into accounts to give back the tax that had been taken. The Coalition was going to abolish that, has in fact legislated to abolish it, and now they're effectively reinstating it. And the cuts to company tax.
Before we move on to the company tax, yeah. I want to take a call from Maggie, who's joined us. She's from, well, near Ballarat, actually. Tell us, Maggie, there was complete silence, you say, on the aged pension.
Yes. I mean, I'm so used to over the years, you know, pensions being such a big part of a budget, but absolute silence on age pension this year. And I don't know whether that's good or bad.
Well, let's ask. Let's find out. Peter?
I've just done a word search on the budget measures document. I searched for age pension. I can confirm that is correct. The government still has a plan. It hasn't got through the Senate to lift the age of pension eligibility to 70 years, and doubtless it will proceed with that. But it's one of these things where what they don't do is significant, because think back to Hockey's first budget. He was going to change the way pensions increased, so they increased by CPI, which we all know is pitifully low, so low it's going backwards, changed the way the pension was indexed. And there was a huge fight over that. The government lost, and it isn't reinstating it. It isn't going back to doing it.
Maggie, that must include you. Are you an aged pensioner?
Partial aged pensioner, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And are you finding it tricky?
Look, no, not at this stage. that's what worries me. You know, my comfort zone needs to have direction from the government. Am I, you know, yelling against it or yelling for it?
I thought you'd be happy to be left alone.
Absolutely, yes. You know, they say we fade into the background as we got older. I think I stayed dead.
Well, yeah, keeping a small target can be a good idea at sometimes. Cheryl, what are your thoughts on the age pension?
Well, as Peter said, there isn't much there. There's nothing there for kind of low to middle income households generally. Childcare, paid parental leave. In fact, there's some, those family tax benefit cuts are still sort of, you know, locked in there from the 2014 budget, and we'll see what happens after the election, whether sort of they come through. But yesterday, you know, Scott Morrison in the budget lockup was saying, we've got to get away from talking about budgets in terms of winners and losers, and that what voters want now, they've moved on from that. They want to see an economic plan that shows a path to the, you know, a proper path to the future. But
there could be something in that, by the way, because that's what our first caller actually said. And the ANU opinion survey they do before every election tends to suggest that people are less concerned about what's in it for them in terms of tax cuts, more concerned about health and education.
Mm. Now, we will be taking some of your calls on. We're very keen to hear what you think about particularly these changes to superannuation. And in a moment, we're going to hear from Michael O'Neill from Australian Seniors. He's ready to join our discussion, particularly on aged pensions. But also some very big moves for the youth sector. Is that going to affect you, or do you know in your area if there are people, young people, who may well benefit from this scheme that we've been hearing about with hiring and training? Are you an employer who might take part? Are you encouraged to take on somebody? Interested to hear from you. The number is 1300 225 76 1300. Call RN. Now, just to Angela, who's giving us a call from Inner Sydney. G'day, Angela.
Hi. What's bothering me is what's not in the budget. I mean, the PM talks about a long-term plan, but there is nothing about climate pollution. We've made commitments in Paris, and there is no way that we're going to fund that without some significant commitment to renewable energy, which has gone backwards in the last 3 years under the current government. We have got no way of making a change that's really going to matter in the long term. We can fuss about which side, whether we're in the ATK club or not in the ATK club. But this is an issue that affects all Australians, and for it to be ignored so significantly in the budget, it's just staggering.
I think we heard Richard Di Natale, the Green Senator, saying that he was surprised that it wasn't a factor in the defence spending that was announced, the enormous, big manufacturing, job-creating and technology-enhancing spending that was announced for defence, that there was no element in that did address clean energy. Thanks for that, Angela.
It hasn't been completely ignored, climate change, because they've put back in the budget the cost of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and the Australian Renewable Energy Agency. You'll remember that the Abbott government slated to abolish those organisations. As we know, the Turnbull government is continuing with them, and now that money is back in the budget as an expense. So at least that's being factored in.
And that will affect people who are coming in to receiving benefits.
That's right. I mean, it was still operating. Those agencies were still operating in the background despite that legislation being stuck in the Senate. So they're just kind of continuing on. Although we did hear from the government, you know, quite radical changes to how the Australian Renewable Energy Agency is funded. It's basically a client now, I think, of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, mm-hmm. and that has got, you know, people a bit concerned, but at least they're still there.
Okay, now we'll get to Michael O'Neill from Australian Seniors in a moment, but to Patrick, who's joined us from Bowral in New South Wales. You're interested in the company tax, Patrick.
Yes, I was paying 50% company tax under Malcolm Fraser. If you tried to put some money into reserve for next year, you paid 50% dividend withholding tax. And when I got a dividend from the company, it was up to 66% tax. So it's ridiculous to give. It would have been much better to give it to, the global warming problem, the renewable energy. That's where it would make the most result. And as for jobs, I'm firmly convinced that the ALP plan of diverting money away from churning old houses, which I don't, I must admit, into new bills. All that money goes into new bills. That clearly means more jobs. You have to train them to that.
Yes, but you're talking about the negative gearing changes proposed by Labor and focusing particularly on new creations, new houses, etc. Let's leave that right there where it is for the moment, Patrick, because it didn't come up in the budget last night. We know there was nothing on housing, in fact, affordability at all, but certainly nothing on the negative gearing. Let's go to Michael O'Neill from Australian Seniors. Welcome, Michael.
Good to be with you.
Now, there was a lot in the whole super changes, but can we just talk about aged pensions? How are national seniors seeing, the Australian seniors seeing people who are on an aged pension? Have they been ignored?
Basically, I think there's been very little in the pension space, a negative in terms of people's access to the clean energy supplement funds. If you're a new entrant into the pension space going forward, you won't be a recipient of the $366 a year that people currently, single people currently get, or $550 for couples. So that's a slight tweak there, but that will disadvantage people entering that space. More generally in the pension area, directly on pensions, no other impacts. Obviously, the superannuation changes now and going forward will be particularly impactful for levels of super, and obviously with that the reliance on the pension or otherwise.
Mm. Now, to super, we saw some moves for women to kind of play catch up. What do you make of those? I mean, the idea that women take out years of their working life to care for children and also carers as well. Are they really going to be able to either put money in later on into their super, and also this idea that partners can top up their spouse's super? What do you think of those changes?
Look, I think they're a good start in terms of actually starting to do something about a problem that's been identified now for quite some time, for decades, that the levels of balances that women finish within super as a result of interrupted work careers, as a result of unequal pay compared to men, is an issue that needs to be dealt with. I think this is a start. I think it's a tentative start, and it will rely on, to be successful, will certainly rely on, I think, other measures that deal with that, the salary gap, the difference between male and female, I think access to childcare and similar support measures for women to return to the workplace or to be recognised in some way for that contribution that they continue to make in providing care, whether for children, grandchildren, perhaps aged parents increasingly, recognising that and in some form super being topped up is part of the next stage, I think, that needs to be addressed.
One of the other things that happened yesterday was the rate change, the cash rate going from 2% down to 1.75. Now, I think there was a bit of an intake of breath in certain areas about that. It was a little unexpected. That is not great news for self-funded retirees. How's that sector doing with these increasingly low rates and possibly another one on the way, another cut on the way?
Well, this is the 11th consecutive reduction. So clearly that means people's return on their investments will continue to reduce. Older Australians, whether self-funded or partly self-funded, part pension, have a preference for bank deposits, particularly term deposits, because they're attracted to the security and certainty that they provide. People, as a consequence, have seen their incomes reduced. Their incomes have come down. Their retirement plans, in many cases, will need to be altered to reflect their changed circumstances. People celebrate, and rightly so, the benefits of reduced interest rates for borrowers, but they're actually bad news for savers and older Australians, particularly falling in that into that group.
Yeah, it's a really tricky time, isn't it? The lowest cash rate in history. If you're out there trying to do it yourself, it's very, very difficult. Thank you very much for just that little moment from your perspective, Michael.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Let's hear two sides of this super discussion, and then we'll hear from Cheryl and Peter again. Peter is in Melbourne. Now, Peter, you're quite keen on these changes to super.
Oh, look, I think they're fantastic. I think reaffirming that the purpose of super is about lifting retirement incomes and not wealth accumulation is absolutely brilliant and long overdue. And I think when you put that together with the extra help for low-income people and women with, particularly women with interrupted work histories, to put more into super, I think I'd probably disagree with Michael O'Neill that there's nothing in here for pensioners, because when I take a longer-term view, I think the future pensioners of Australia are going to be much better off through these changes.
Yes, right. Well, so that's some of that long-term thinking that the Prime Minister and the Treasurer have been asking us to do in receiving this in this budget. And you, what's your particular circumstance, Peter? Are you able to, you know, are you a self-funded retiree?
I am a self-funded retiree, and I'm more than happy to have the top end of the superannuation concessions lopped off. In fact, I would have been happier if they'd lopped a bit harder and redirected that money to low-income people.
Mm, okay, thanks for that, Peter. Now, back to Cheryl. That whole picture for people who are, above the age of 45, I guess, is shifting quite quickly. What do we read from some of these changes, particularly to super?
To super, well, I actually think they are really good. I mean, we were, all the leaks left us with, I think, fairly, well, certainly me, low expectations that super tax concessions for the wealthy would be significantly wound back. But they have gone much further than expected. I mean, I think the total cost, the tax concessions for the wealthy will actually be slashed by something like $6 billion. So not insignificant. And half of that money will be redirected towards, you know, bolstering presumably the retirement incomes of low-income people and particularly women. I think that catch-up thing where you can top up unused concessional contributions from the past is a good idea, because it's kind of like women's career patterns. I mean, of course people say, well, who can put even $20,000 away a year in their super? But if you look at women's career paths, they're on low incomes, perhaps when they enter the workforce, they have children, of course, there's no income, and then they come back. And if they've got a career path, they will start earning more and more. So at that point, they may be able to put more money into their super so they can use this to kind of catch up. So I think that's a really a good idea, and it does make it more sustainable. The thing, you know, I think is really interesting about this is that this other measure where the government will limit the amount that can be transferred into tax-free retirement pensions to $1.6 million, that's the balance above that you have to pay, start paying tax, that's chipping away at, remember Peter Costello, one of the last big things that's still there from Peter Costello's largesse before the GFC, and that was to make retirement savings tax-free after the age of 60. Now, this opening the door for this to be changed, and Scott Morrison has actually made this retrospective. It means current retirees will have to move any excess amounts above that amount, $1.6 million, from their pensions, presumably into another fund where it'll be taxed. So, you've got to give them a tick for tackling this. I mean, I think everybody, Labor, Liberal, all the major parties, even people who have those high balances in super and are putting, they recognise that it's largely become a rort, that it isn't about a comfortable retirement. It's about intergenerational sort of wealth transfer. And yeah, I think everybody accepts that something had to change.
I think that's right. And I think there'll be quite a lot of people quickly talking to their bank managers this morning about what they can do in this.
Oh, no, they can't,
that's right,
Cassie.
And that's the thing.
No. Look, one of the measures is retrospective. The other comes in at 7:30 p.m. on the 3rd of May, which when I looked was last night. So this is an anti-Costello. Peter Costello changed the super rules and gave people a year to pour in more money, which they did and then lost it in the subsequent GFC. Unfortunate timing.
Yeah, bad
this
timing.
Is anti-Costello, and it's retrospective in... If you've got more than $1.6 billion paying you super, You'll have to get it down. You've got.
I wonder how Philip Ruddock will be affected by that, departing last night as the father of the Parliament. Wonder if it was before or after 7:30.
He's on a different. He's on the kind of scheme that mortals could only dream of.
We on Life Matters are talking about the budget. We're hearing from you. What do you think? And how will you be affected? We can answer your questions too. In a moment, we're going to talk to Kate Acheson. She's from the Youth Affairs Coalition. As we heard, some very interesting changes for younger unemployed people. Are they happy with the PATH scheme, which we'll talk about in a moment? Are you going to be participating in that, or are you likely to hire someone because of it? But first, let's go to Roger in Sydney. Now, you're a small business owner, Roger.
That's right, I am. And I happen to be earning about $86,000 a year, plus I'm 64 years old, so I'm very interested in what's been going on.
Yeah, you've probably been up all night. Tell us what you think.
Well, very simply what I think is probably going off what I've just said in terms of topic, but I feel that the very small concession that I would get, I'd much rather see that going into public hospitals, education. I think a lot of people do now. I think just getting a few dollars in your hand and then saying, oh, by the way, if you do need to go to hospital, it's going to be pretty tough for you, I think is a tough thing to do. So the people who need it most will probably, you know, be the people who pay for it, unfortunately. But I would like to say that I do think in the whole scenario of what we're looking at, there's a lack of looking forward and being creative. So as a small business person, you know that to stay in business, you do need to create your own business. And looking at the broad business of government, I can't really see that happening. So I can't see the embrace of sustainable energy technologies. I can't look forward and see how we're going to actually challenge the future, especially with things like where we have infrastructure still being material things like roads, etc., and rail, where infrastructure is really the people. So it is education, it is health, it is certainly things like, you know, NBN, you know, it is things like being connected to the rest of the world efficiently. So in Brookvale, for instance, I can't even get a regular sort of landline working for data. So, you know, I think there's an opportunity, there's a huge opportunity there, and we have to actually be forward-facing. But at the moment, I think this whole area is looking at what we've got, what we've done in the past, and then shrinking back into a much smaller-minded economy. And I just think we'll all lose out if we don't get stuck into what's coming in front of us.
Yeah, $6 a week doesn't get you much at all. But I guess if you are a low income family, that is what, $630 a year, you'd be better off. That might be useful maybe for putting into your super. Let's hear from Kate Acheson. She's the Youth Affairs Coalition head, and she's been looking at the way younger people will be affected. Kate, are you happy with what you're hearing?
Oh, it's a bit of a mixed bag, really. I mean, we're really excited that the changes to the Work for the Dole have finally come. We know that the program wasn't really working. It wasn't getting young people into secure jobs. And so the PATH program is a much better alternate to that. But it isn't exactly what the government's saying, which they're touting it as tackling youth unemployment and creating new jobs. And it's not necessarily going to do that.
So it's a big, warm, cuddly, different approach to the one that we saw 2 years ago, which was 6 months, was it, until you were able to access benefits, etc. But, you know, a few questions like, are people really going to take on young people and put all this effort into them? Will young people stick around if it's just, you know, $4 an hour? I think someone's done the crunching on what that $200 a fortnight on top of your new start or dole would be.
I mean, yeah, it's not. I mean, we shouldn't underestimate the interest of young people in getting a real job. I mean, young people are desperate for real work. They want to get into the labour market. They want to be able to start their lives. They want to be able to pay their rent and move out of home, and, you know, at least be able to afford renting their own place, let alone the dream of buying a house, which obviously we know with housing affordability, which wasn't tackled in this budget, sadly. But, you know, that young people are really keen to start getting into work. And so this is actually a good step in the right direction in saying that we want to make employers and young people come together. What's missing is that we didn't necessarily talk to young people. We don't have a minister for youth. We don't have the peak body isn't sort of funded. We don't have that voice into parliament saying what young people actually need. So this is a really good start, but it is just a start in what we really need to do, which is tackling the huge unemployment for young people. It's over double that for what it is for adults, and we really need young people to be engaged so that they can be the future generation paying our taxes, making sure that we can have pensions and hospitals, and like your caller said, we really need those sort of structures in place, and young people are the tax sort of base that we need in the future.
Mm. Cheryl Bagwell, we have relatively low unemployment for the general population, something just over 5%. But youth is a big sector in unemployment. I think sometimes in Tasmania, you know, it's into the 20s in some parts and other rural and regional areas of Australia. Can you see this being a big incentive for small businesses to take on young people?
Well, we had the head of the Australian Council of Small Business on breakfast program this morning. He says that small business will respond to this, that they will take this up. I mean, there are pretty good incentives there for businesses. They'll receive an upfront payment of $1,000 to host them. They can get subsidies of up to $10,000 if they actually give them a real job, you know, that after the internship, after the training and internship, they then decide we want to hire this person. If that's an enduring job, they could get wage subsidies of $10,000. I mean, youth unemployment is a scourge, you know, of our labour market. I mean, it's a terrible situation. The government, I mean, it's such a big turnaround, again, from the Abbott government. I mean, we've gone from the stick to the carrot to try and tackle long-term youth unemployment. You know, it was only a couple of years ago that I think the Employment Minister, Erica Betts, at the time was saying that young people had to, do 40 applications for jobs per week if they wanted to get the New Start allowance, and, you know, they'd wait 6 months. And now we're coming at it at a different way. I understand it's only a start. I mean, I think it's only for about 30,000 job seekers. But if the response from small business is like, yeah, we'll give this a go, I mean, it's worth trying. I think, you know, it's a kind of change of tone that we need.
Mm. Peter Martin, what do you think about... Oh, go on, what were you going to say?
No, it's... acting on the basis of evidence as to what works. Everyone knows the work for the dole scheme doesn't work. Heaps of studies have found that. People are stigmatised by it. Acting on the evidence about youth unemployment, acting on overwhelming evidence about superannuation, acting on evidence, disputed evidence, about company tax. This is very different to the first budget, which had an ideological view about denying the dole to people for 6 months at a time, about working for the dole to punish these people, in ways that would stigmatise them, and had it's recently as 9 months ago an absolute commitment that super benefits for the high earners, for the rich, were going to stay. There's nothing that I can see, apart from perhaps that tax cut for people on $80,000, there's nothing that's ideological that's playing to the base. I don't know the makeup, whether it was Turnbull or Morrison, but it seems to reflect Malcolm Turnbull's desire to, or interest, he says, is a relentless picker of other people's brains, interest in seeking out the evidence.
Okay, well, let's go back to Katie Atchison on that, but also keen to hear from you, 1300 225 576, 1300 22 call RN. We've got some calls that we'll go to in a moment. But Katie, what about that idea that this is a turnaround in approach? Is the coalition actually kind of responding to some backlash that might have an impact electorally?
I'd hope so. That would be great, because obviously there's 1.5 million young voters, so that's 18 to 24-year-olds, and they're the swing vote in this election. So young people are the vote that the polls can't count on, because they go with issues. And so it really is about what these young what young people and young voters think the government is listening to. And the question is this enough? Is it actually about young people or is this about small business? I think it's going a little bit of both ways. Hopefully this is a good start and a good sign for the election that the government is actually concerned about those young people and is going to start trying to address their issues, because we don't actually see it anywhere else in this budget. Young people aren't a focus here. Yes. This is their big ticket item. And it is, like I said before, it is a start, and I do think it is a good incentive for employers to get involved with young people and young workers.
As we know, young voters are generally unaligned for a while, and I guess this is going to neutralise any negative feeling, but may not necessarily have them turning to the coalition in droves. All right, thank you very much for joining us this morning, Katie.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's Katie Atchison from the Youth Affairs Coalition giving us a perspective on this federal budget from I guess the under-29s. Is that what they call them these days? Let's hear from Rose in Melbourne on a very important issue, hospital funding.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, hi. What's your thoughts, Rose?
Yeah, just the local hospital where I work hasn't had an increase in funding for the acute care team for the last 20 years, as far as I'm aware, and they basically got double the number of people they're seeing. And, of course, when those people that get a very small tax cut have to go to hospital, or their relatives have to go to hospital and they're suicidal, etc., a lot more people will not be getting the services that they really need at that time, and so consequently could possibly be endangered and die as a result of the lack of that funding. So I think it doesn't really help people if the hospital's funding is just staying the same or being reduced, and people have got double the workload and can't take care of their clients properly. People are dying on our wait list, or people are being discharged out of hospital too early and end up suiciding, or it's not really going to help anyone very much.
Rose, thank you for raising that really important point. It's interesting, Peter and Cheryl, that we're hearing really that people aren't fussed by a tax cut at all, and that the concerns are making sure the system is funded adequately. To you, Peter, I know that you've got to roll on. Your final thoughts on that? Actually, I'll go to
That's
Cheryl first.
Cheryl.
Cheryl, to you first. I know you're the one who's racing out to your next engagement.
The government is playing on that in a sense by saying in order to keep funding the services that people care about, we need to have a sustainable budget, so we need to do certain things. We must, live within our means and such like that. And I think that message, after the kind of crazy shrieking budget emergency kind of situation of a couple of years ago, people are understanding now that as the population ages and less people in the workforce, that we've got to sit down and have a serious conversation about how we do manage to keep these services at the level that they should be in a first world country. Of course, there's debates between the major parties about how much that would be. I mean, obviously, Labor is saying that they would fund it, tip much more money into schools and hospitals than the coalition does, but now the coalition claims that have found a hole in their budgeting with the tobacco tax being overinflated in terms of the revenue. That argy-bargy will go on, but I think people are starting to think, and they're saying in polls, yes, I would accept my taxes rising if it was hypothecated, if that money was going into the things that I wanted to go into. And we've seen that in Northern Europe, that people do accept higher taxes if they trust the government that the money will be spent in the right places. But this is going to be a big issue. I mean, the budget is being framed as sort of fair and prudent and such, but it's really kicking the budget repair situation down the road, kicking that can down the road to a time when these costs are going to rise exponentially. And, I talked to the ratings agencies last night. The government's dodged a bullet. Keeping the AAA credit rating there for the time being.
But just for now. For now, it's not. I know we're going to lose you in a moment, Cheryl.
Okay.
So thank you very much for being with us this morning and sort of sifting through the entrails of what, you know, is a very interesting budget indeed.
Cheryl, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Cheryl Bagwell is business editor for ABCRN's Breakfast. You will have heard her working this morning, and she was hard at it also all last night. But Peter Martin is with us, and Cheryl raised that tobacco tax. And just before we move on, I know that we want to talk about education, and we're going to hear about the way that particularly schools are affected in a moment from Dr. Glenn Savage. But just to that tobacco tax, now this, Labor says it's going to raise, they were hoping on it raising a lot more, something like, I think, $40 billion. Mm. Nothing like that in terms of what the coalition is saying. But can we just look at the people who are going to be affected by it? And if you go to the Federal Department of Health's website and look at who smokes most, now these are the specific population groups. It's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. It's people in remote places. It's people on low socioeconomic and employment status. They're three times more likely to smoke. We also know that mental illness and smoking have links. Is this a fair tax?
Oh, yes. You don't help those people by hastening their deaths. Cigarettes are the only product that anyone can think of that's, when used exactly as directed, eventually
life threatening. Sure, that's the moral argument.
It's a serious argument. If you are saying that, you know, this is what David Lynehelm, the Liberal Democrat senator, says, that it's a regressive tax, you are hurting poor people.
You're
helping them.
Tony Abbott called it the workers' tax. But it's the percentage of income that's important. In 4 years' time, a packet of 25 cigarettes is going to cost $40. Now, I, as much as anyone, don't want anyone to smoke, and I know how hard it is to quit. As a naughty girl at school, I had to go through learning how to quit smoking. I don't think anyone wants to see it. But what about the damage that's done by, say, alcohol, or what about the other areas of our, you know, social life?
I've been campaigning for a sugar tax, right? For a tax on soft drinks, as the UK has done. So I fully agree on that, but sugar can be useful in small quantities and alcohol can be useful in small quantities. Cigarettes kill people. You do someone no favours. Actually, you do them a lot of favours by pricing it out, because as soon as people give it up, that very large whack, proportionately twice as much.
I'm interested to hear from you, if you're listening to this and you have a strong feeling about the idea of cigarettes. 1-300-225-576. You know, it is easier to give up if you have more social capital. I think that's unarguable.
Yes.
Let's hear from Glenn Savage, Dr. Glenn Savage from the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. Morning, Glenn.
Good morning.
What's the perspective from people in the education sector?
Well, look, it's certainly been a wild ride over the last few months when it comes to the coalition's position on school funding. I mean, you know, up until Sunday, there was absolutely no clarity at all over what the coalition had in mind for school funding. So on the positive side, at least the announcement on budget night has given some clarity as to where they're planning to go with schools.
And so, which sector do you think will be most welcoming of this? The private or the public? Any other?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the plan of their centrepiece announcement is the $1.2 billion commitment for needs-based school funding between 2018 and 20. Now, this plan falls well short of the $4.5 billion that has been promised by Labor between 2018 and 19 as part of the Gonski model. So on the one hand, it's a win for supporters of increased school funding who feared that there would be further cuts, since the coalition announced late last year that it would dump the Gonski reforms entirely. But then on the other hand, people will say, and Labor are saying, that the amount being offered is inadequate and that much more money is needed to be channeled into disadvantaged schools that need the most support.
Mm. And do you think that the tertiary education sector will have any kind of complaints about what they've heard?
Well, I think, you know, both the tertiary sector and the schooling sector have been very confusing and very complex over the last few months. It's been very difficult to work out what the agenda is of the federal government in those areas. I mean, on the positive side for schools, I think we're seeing that the coalition is taking steps to ensure that any new money that they give to schools is used more efficiently. They're seeking to impose new conditions on how money is spent in schools. And Education Minister Simon Birmingham has said that this will help tie the funding to evidence-based initiatives that will technically lift student performance and results. Mm. So I think this is a smart move, because I think debates of the last few years have been really hijacked by a focus on how much cash schools are getting, instead of focusing on the more important question of what schools do with the money. So I think we should welcome a more finely tuned approach to school funding.
Mm. Okay, so another neutralising perhaps of a potential election flare spot. Thank you very much for that, Glenn, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Glenn Savage from the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. Peter, just would you like to respond to that? And then I think we have to take a few calls from smokers and ex-smokers who are coming.
There's not a Turnbull, sorry, there's not an Abbott and Hockey measure really that this budget hasn't tried to undo. So funding for hospitals, the government was in the absurd position of going to increase it by far less than the cost of running hospitals. That they've now restored funding increasing by the cost of running hospitals. Not going as far as Kevin Rudd would have done, but they've restored the cut in future spending. They've done the same for education. They've undone what he would have done on superannuation, and certainly undone lots of Peter Costello moves. This is, as I wrote, something of a Labor budget. The only exception is on most things it's not quite as Labor as Labor. On superannuation, it's actually gone further than Labor had the courage to do.
Mm, interesting. Just very much in the context of a pre-election environment. On Life Matters, I'm Cassie McCullough. With me is Peter Martin, the economics editor from The Age. And we are taking your calls this morning on some of your reaction to the federal budget. The number 1300 225 576. And of course, if you are in Western Australia or in South Australia and the Northern Territory, you can leave a message on the listener line 02 833 1430. Now to some people on smoking and the tobacco tax. Paddy in Port Macquarie.
Yes, I think the tax is absolutely brilliant. I think the cigarettes should be as expensive as we can possibly make them. And I apologise to everybody who's paying for them at the moment and is addicted. But as a young person, I was on a very low income, and I would be very surprised if I would ever have taken up smoking if the cigarettes were more expensive. And as an adult, I greatly regret having taken them up, not just for myself, but all the people that were influenced by me smoking. You know, both of my brothers still smoke to this day, and I'm sure they wouldn't have if I had never taken up smoking.
Mm, so a prohibitive on people taking it up. But what about those people who are smoking now? I mean, do you feel for, say, I don't know, a single parent who's got, any...
I feel for the single parent's children if their mother's smoking, because sooner or later there's a very high chance that there's going to be some kind of illness related to that smoking, never mind the fact that in my experience, particularly from a low socioeconomic background, which I have myself, you know, parents don't tend always to smoke away from their children. And, you know, we love our kids and we want to do the best by them, but we're kind of victim to our addiction. And anything that's going to help people to make a decision to make a change, a positive yep. change, is a good thing.
Mm, okay. And, well, nothing like a reformist, Paddy. Thanks for that. A reformed smoker, I mean. Chris from Maryborough, you've got a similar train of thought.
I have, because, I used to smoke. I came up in 1986 to smoke a couple of packets a day. And Winfield Red for a whole carton of 10 packets back in 1986 at Woolworths was $10.50 for the whole 10 packets.
Yep.
And
well,
I
there
used
you
to
go.
Think that was, I think I used to think that was the back then, you know.
That's forward planning, future planning.
Yes, but I do believe the the tax is a scam, a government scam to make a lot of money, which they are. And I think there's going to be, there's a lot of people won't give up, no matter what, a lot of the down and outers and those living the bottom end of the scale, that's lifestyle they have, and cigarettes is just part of that, unfortunately.
Yep.
And little children are just going to miss out on having, you know, food and fruit and things that they need because of parents.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that, Chris. Yeah, okay. So they're going to miss out. But also, I guess there's another argument, and that is that you're going to see a rise in the black market. I don't know if that's true. Let's hear from Bob from Melbourne. What do you reckon, Bob?
Morning. Yeah, look, I'm surprised that Peter Martin, an old 2XX community radio head, is putting forward this nonsense at the moment. I mean, how much does it cost to police a black market? It's $4 billion a year that taxpayers pay in Australia now to police a black market in marijuana. So you can go down to any pub in Melbourne or in Canberra these days and you can buy half a kilo of Chop Chop for, you know, a tenth of the price of what you're paying to cigarettes.
Okay, so Chop Chop being like a kind of unregulated tobacco, like a sort of freestyle roll-it-yourself, who knows what is in it, where it's come from.
No, and that's a very good point because you don't know. And that's the thing, is that if the government and, you know, economics writers like Peter keep on saying this...
let's leave Peter out of it. I mean,
no, he's got a price to pay here, I reckon. The same as a lot of them do, you know, those economics writers. But it's seriously, $4 billion a year to keep a prohibition on marijuana, and we're going to see that escalate on tobacco as they keep pumping prices up.
All right. Thank you for that, Bob. Peter, right of
the
reply.
The government is indeed onto the problem. In the budget, they're spending $7.7 million over 2 years to expand the Department of Immigration and Border Force tobacco strike team. So they're aware of this, but compared to the money they're making, right? No, of course they're aware of it. And there's nothing, these prices may seem high. The World Health Organization recommends 70% of the price of a cigarette be taxed. This will take us up to 69. It'll take us to about what other countries regard as a reasonable target.
All right, well, let's hear from a few more callers. Matt in Sunnybank. Young people aren't smoking as much.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the latest statistics show, isn't it? That we're seeing less young people taking up cigarettes, which has got to be for the better long-term health of the country, I would have thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I imagine also that the argument that, we're taxing those now, there's a fair bit of health spending that actually goes to looking after people that have been seriously ill from smoking, you know, for a long time. So that should take some weight off the budget.
Okay. Yeah, thanks very much for that, Matt. We are just about out of time. I do know that Joe from Lithgow thinks that alcohol should be taxed more, that it's another driver of social evil. And also Paul from Northern New South Wales, who's given us a call to say that smoking tax will cut into his food bills. He's not going to be able to make that choice to give it up. Peter Martin, you've been a workhorse for us today. Thank you very much for being there and fielding calls.
Cassie, I've done something else for you. I've tweeted to Life Matters. This is an experiment. Life Matters can tweet it back. The graph that shows how attitudes to spending on health and tax cuts have changed over time from ANU. It's quite dramatic. Mm. If Life Matters tweets it, people will be able to see it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We will retweet that and look forward to your response. Thank you to Peter Martin. He's the economics editor from The Age. Lots to think about there and lots to digest, but we are getting a clearer picture emerging of that budget. Well, that's it for Life Matters. Thanks for your company. I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next time.